Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Good morning, Matt.
Morning, Stu.
I'm kind of excited about this conversation today for Thrive Deeper because I'd have to be honest and say I've not done a whole lot of research previously on this sort of intertestamental period, which is what we're going to be talking about today, listeners. We're covering the period between what was the last sort of written history in our Old Testament, a book of Malachi and sort of Nehemiah and Joel, all sort of around that time as well. The gap of about 400, maybe 450 years between then and then when we pick up again in Matthew, unless you kind of do the research and know your history, you don't really know much of what happened, but there...
It's very important, though,
absolutely.
In terms of, you know, the Judaism that we see in the New Testament is really the product of what happens in between.
Yeah.
And there's some great stories here, Stu.
And the context, even with some of the reactions and the relationships that we hear with Jesus and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you start to understand that in such a whole new way when you do this research. So welcome, listeners. This is going to be a bit of a drinking from a fire hydrant, I think, because we're going to try to cover a 450-odd year period in a short amount of time. Before we jump in, Matt, a couple of things I want to state as a bit of my observation. One of the first things is I don't think we should ever think that in this intertestamental period where there was really nothing in our Bibles that God wasn't active. God wasn't absent, here.
Yeah.
It was just that there was no formally acknowledged prophets by the Jews who were the ones that were considered to be the only ones who would write into Scripture or the Tanakh or the Jewish Bible. So that's why there's nothing written there. But there were lots of other scholars and rabbis and people writing the history of what happened in this period. And we do have that information of what was happening historically. So and we'll talk a bit about that, where that comes from. A couple of key places, the Book of Maccabees, which is in the one of the apocryphal
books of Maccabees,
which is part of the apocryphal books. But also historian Josephus, who wrote sometime later around 70 AD, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So there was some, and lots of others. So that's the first thing. The second thing, it sometimes helps us recognize that the story of the Bible is part of God's work in history. There were lots of other things going on in the world at this time as well. And I thought it might be useful just to quickly run through some of the things that happened sort of from 500 BC right up to 1 AD when Christ was born. For instance, 500 BC, Buddha begins Buddhism. That's where that kind of began. This was the time of Herodotus. The Romans begin to build a republic around then.
Yeah, that's right.
The Parthenon, Socrates. As we move into 400 BC, this is when London was founded. The Celts moved into England at that point in time. That's the time of Aristotle. We'll talk about Alexander the Great as well and the Hellenistic Age, which we'll cover a fair bit in this episode we're going to be talking about. 300 BC is suggested around about, or not known for sure, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were probably written, somewhere between 300 and 100. The Qin Dynasty unifies China, and that was when the Great Wall of China was commissioned to be built. This is in 300 BC. And then, of course, as we move into 200 BC, Rome conquers the last Etruscan city in the Italian peninsula. The parachute is invented in China. Rome conquers Greece, and we'll hear a bit about that.
I'd like to know what they're jumping
on. Oh, yeah, exactly. Off a cliff somewhere, probably. This is the time of Julius Caesar. And then, of course, as we move into the end of the BC era, into 1 AD, this is where we talk about Jesus' birth. So there's just some things, other things that were going on in the world.
And just to pick a couple of things out of there, I mean, you have the heyday of sort of Greek philosophy, this Greek philosophical movement, which I think is important. I mean, this is happening in Greece, but this is... there's a bunch of Greek philosophers that are casting aside all the old myths of the gods because it's kind of chaotic and they're endlessly fighting with each other and they're looking for something beyond that. It's this reaching for beyond that. And so this becomes important because the Jewish faith, which is quite an enclave, by the time we get to the first century, the Christian movement that's going to go out to the Gentiles is really going to speak powerfully to the kinds of questions that people are asking or had been asking for sort of already 400 years through this period. So that's, important. And of course, the Romans become very important.
Yes,
and Daniel in his prophecy had predicted, the coming of this other, other force. And so,
and
particularly
a lot of,
from about 200 BC, we're going to see the Romans coming into this story.
Yeah. And there's quite a bit in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, that actually prophesies into this period that we're about to talk about right now.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right.
Take it away, Matt.
You know, so the last sort of stories that we looked at, of course, there was Malachi, but the story of Nehemiah, and you might remember that Nehemiah expelled Manasseh, a grandson of the high priest, for having married this daughter of Sanballat. You know, listeners remember that. Well, Manasseh goes off and with the sort of stamp of approval of the Persian king to build a rival temple, actually, on Mount Gerizim in Samaria. And so, you know, we see this happen just after the time that we've already looked at.
And of course, that goes forward to when Jesus is talking to the woman at the well about, and she's saying, we worship on this mountain and you worship on that mountain. Which one's correct?
Yeah. Which is the right temple?
That's exactly what they're referring to there.
Yeah, exactly. So from after the time of Malachi, we actually don't know much. That there's a period of about 100 years where we really don't know that much. The Jews seem to have suffered some calamity in the mid sort of 4th century BC, around sort of 350 BC. We don't know. It had something to do with their involvement with the Phoenicians in a revolt, which was really brutally suppressed by the Persians. And there probably was mass exile at this time.
So a lot of scattering.
So a lot of the Jewish diaspora that, for example, the Apostle Paul is constantly connecting with may have come from this period. And actually throughout this period, we'll see that there are plenty of reason to see why the Jews spread out into different areas.
Mm. And remember also after Jeremiah, in fact, got taken to Egypt, to southern Egypt, and there's probably there was already prior to this, you know, probably a fairly significant Jewish community down there.
The Egyptian Jewish community. In fact, they actually built a rival temple there and they had all of the sacrificial system down in Elephantine in Egypt. That was, that existed by 525 BC already. So that was well underway there. So this is the period also where the office of high priest essentially becomes, you know, of course, Nehemiah was the governor. He passes that on to his brother. But actually what happens during this period is that the high priesthood becomes quite a politicized office. Now that's going to become quite problematic. It's sort of okay at first, but this is going to become quite problematic.
So when you say that, what you mean is rather than it just being a position within a religious order, it becomes actually almost like the governor or the mayor it's a political position, really.
Yeah. Yep. And Judaism through this period seems to have very much become a religion of the law and of law keeping. So that's another, you know, distinctive thing that's important for this story. With all of these, you know, the scattering, the Jews scattered all over the place, this is also the period where synagogues were established.
Right. Because they all couldn't get to the temple.
That's right. Exactly. So they're focused around the law. They can't get to the temple. So, you know, the synagogues that Paul, again, is going to all over the empire happen. I mean, look, already Jews were scattered from, you know, 600 BC, you know, when Solomon's temple was destroyed. And there was a scattering there. But it's actually particularly through this period that you get the synagogue movement really establishing because there are still Jews going out with this very law-focused approach. They're going to found the synagogues. With this comes the rise of the Targums. They're expositions of the law that were used in the synagogues as well.
So like sermons in a sense?
Yeah, they're basically sermons. Yep. It's kind of a commentary on the law that are central now to sit beside the scriptures for Jewish people, the Targums, as a sort of source of commentary on the law. This is also a period when Aramaic gradually replaces Hebrew. Persian language is Aramaic. So the Persian Empire was incredibly powerful empire. Very sophisticated and powerful empire. So this is, you know, this lasts a long time, you know, compared to, say, Babylon, which lasts a fairly short time, but the Persian Empire is
huge as well.
Yeah. It wasn't until Alexander the Great, of course, that the Persian Empire is defeated. And some of our listeners may know about Alexander the Great and his extensive victories right across to India. So Alexander defeats the Persians and he comes down, he actually lays siege to Tyre. which is just up north. Yeah.
So you might remember we talked about Tyre in the book.
Well, it was in Jeremiah.
Ezekiel, I think, as well.
Yes, and Ezekiel.
Ezekiel, yeah. where there's
Jeremiah
a prophecy,
and Ezekiel.
Because it's an island and no one had been able to sort of take this island. And then Ezekiel prophesies the fact that they're going to push the villages and all the little cities that are on the land around it into the sea. And essentially, Alexander the Great builds a land bridge.
That's exactly what he does.
To get to Tyre and exactly right. And take it.
Yeah, that's right. Now, he calls on the Jews for help at this time, which they refuse to give. And you'd think, oh, man, now he's going to come and wipe them out. But actually, as Josephus tells the story, apparently he has a dream where he sees a high priest in a dream. And in the dream, the high priest tells him that he's going to be victorious over the Persians. So when he comes into to Jerusalem, he is met by the high priest.
They come out of the city from behind the walls because they'd also heard that he was coming, and they were obviously praying about that and decided we're going to go out and meet.
That's right. So they go out and meet him. I think maybe they didn't think that he was going to be able to actually.
I don't think
victory against Tyre.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. I don't think they were expecting him to be there. But
what their prophets had said.
Yeah, but I think also they had alliance to Darius with Persia. Yeah. Like they were kind of caught between two things here, really, probably,
they were,
to be honest.
And there's going to be a lot of that through this period. Yeah. So he actually goes in, apparently, according to Josephus, he's taken to Jerusalem where he offers a sacrifice to God, to Yahweh.
Well, so first of all, so I come back because I think there was an important thing. So he has this vision, he meets with the priests, and he basically honors them because of this vision that he'd seen. And I guess they were somewhat kind of, oh, well, this is work going well. And they invited him in. And as you say, he went into the temple.
That's right. And he offers this sacrifice. Of course, he does in everything at the high priest's direction.
Yes, of course.
And everything like that. So he goes down, he conquers Egypt, he founds Alexandria, I should say.
Yep.
So his conquest creates this great unified empire. And Alexander the Great, he's a student of Aristotle. We mentioned Aristotle before, the philosopher. Mm. And so he basically forms a kind of cultural unity over the whole sort of area. It's something like what, perhaps the British Empire, or perhaps even more what the sort of Americanization of the world is now.
Yeah, rather than trying to destroy everyone else's culture and make it yours, he was kind of willing to kind of have, to take the best and be part of the best, and encouraged his men to intermarry with the different places.
Right.
And, he was either super smart or just a little naive, because, of course, that's what got him, I suspect, fairly significant loyalty from these countries that he was taking over.
Yeah,
because
that's right.
The people could continue with their life and their culture. And
which was a smart move on his part. So he, he's not, and we're going to see that not all of his successors are going to do the same. So while on the one hand, he has great toleration and respect for all the different religions, I think that works. Yet what happens now is that Greek language and Greek culture starts to spread throughout this area. And actually that's going to be a key unifying force. And this is the time when the common Greek, Koine Greek, the New Testament is written in Koine Greek. And this is the reason for that. It's Alexander's conquest
and in fact, this was probably the time of the first translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Koine Greek, was it? Or not
yet? That's a little bit later.
Okay.
We'll talk about that because, again, we're going to see more Jews moving down into Egypt. So when he dies and
Alexander the Great. And he was pretty young, and he was in the middle of a campaign.
And there's this tussle for power now.
Yeah.
And the two generals, are kind of tussling for power in this area. It's a little bit complicated, but there's basically Ptolemy and Seleucus. And Ptolemies and the Seleucids, as they're known, the Jews are going to be, or Judea is going to be caught in between those. So the Ptolemies are down in Egypt. And now famously, the famous Cleopatra is a Ptolemy.
Yeah,
she's a Ptolemaic a leader. Mm. And then the Seleucids are going to be in the north. Now there's going to be a Seleucid that's going to, cause a lot of problems in a moment. But they're stuck in between and often sort of playing sides off each other. Because remember, they're not a particularly significant, at least at this point, they're not a particularly significant people group. They're caught in between, and so they're having
and they're still
to
reasonly scattered as well, obviously. So, and of course, this is also where Daniel's prophecy of the warring kings in the north and the warring kings in the south, is kind of comes into play as well.
So, in 320, Jerusalem is under the control of the Ptolemy, and He actually takes a number of Jews at that point down into Alexandria in Egypt. And, you know, they get to live there with free status under their own laws. And actually, because of this, a lot of Jews choose to actually move there because it's they have it pretty good down there in Alexandria. And there's this significant Jewish community that forms there. And after a couple of generations, they're all Greek speakers. And so this is where you get, as you mentioned before, this is where you get the first Greek translation of the Old Testament that's known as the Septuagint, because the Sept 70, because apparently it's translated by 70 Jewish elders. And so this is, the Septuagint is the Bible that essentially is being used and quoted from in the New Testament.
It's the Bible Jesus quoted.
That's right. Yeah. So the quotes are from this Greek version of the Bible, because by the first century, Greek, even though it's there under the Romans, yet still in the first century in the time of Jesus and Paul, Greek is the common language of the empire, with Latin being the more official sort of political tongue. So, as I said, at first Judea is under the Ptolemies, but it eventually comes under the Seleucids. There's a lot of back and forth here under Antiochus III. So in 200 BC, it comes under the Seleucids.
Now, there's a bit happening in Greek culture at this point in time, the Hellenization of sort of the Greek culture, which is part of what Alexander the Great's kind of leading the way in, this cultural shift.
Yeah.
And I think this is where the tension begins to rise.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, Greek, the you know, Greek culture is becoming increasingly problematic. Now, at first, you know, the Jews are resistant to this. They have a dynasty of high priests, of Zadokite high priests. Now, that's important because the Zadokite in Ezekiel's prophecy, you know, he sort of seals the fact that of all, I mean, look, the priests were Levites,
yes,
but gradually refined. It was the Zadokite priests that really were the ones that were kind of meant to hold on to the high priesthood, right?
Yeah, right.
The Zadokites, okay. Mm. And that's kind of confirmed in Ezekiel. So there's this Zadokite priesthood known as the Ennaiads, and they absolutely deplored these Greek customs and they sort of held this off. The other rival Greek family was the Tobiads. And this is an interesting question because it goes back to this guy, Tobias, that we talked about under Nehemiah. Remember the guy that was given an office in the temple?
That's right.
And he just keeps finding, I mean, this comes back like this couple of hundred years later and the Tobiad family is still there causing problems.
Exactly what Nehemiah said.
Yeah, because they love this
Hellenism.
Yeah, Hellenism. Now, Hellenism is a way of referring to Greek culture.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a lot about Hellenization.
Of everything else, basically, bringing the Greek culture into whatever culture locally is.
Yeah. Right. So you get this craze for Hellenism in Judea.
Yeah.
And in response to this sort of Hellenistic craze, this group known as the Hasidic Jewish, which is, you know, a group of Jews who are devoted to this kind of cultural distinctness.
Yeah,
essentially. Because remember, distinctness is a very important aspect of the Jewish faith. And this Hellenization of is very problematic for them because they're the ones standing for distinctness.
Well, there was also a lot of stuff within the Hellenization of culture that was really counter to the Jewish law.
Yeah.
They build you know, an athletics kind of field right next to the temple in Jerusalem.
And one of the problems with their gymnasiums, and this is the, I mean, there was this sort of way of life, you know, the Greek way of life, and it often was centered around gymnasiums and sport, right? Now, the problem with this is that Greek youths would go and they would compete naked.
Well, that was what they did.
Yeah, and nudity in public was strictly forbidden, you know, within Judaism. But a lot of Greek life and like connections kind of happened. If you wanted to connect with people, you go to the gymnasium, right? And you know, the baths and that's where everyone would connect and network. And so if you weren't part of that sort of cultural,
you were on the outer.
You were on the outer, right? So the in group is always in the gymnasium, and so this is causing problems. So lots of
Jews, seems to be true today too, man.
That's right. I know. So lots of Jews are leaning into this and thinking, it's fine, and so this is where you get this gradual, this emerging
polarization, emerging, I guess, between those that are happy with that and those that are not.
So now, eventually, a Seleucid ruler called Antiochus IV comes, and I'm just cutting a long story short.
So just before you move there, the Hasidim, you just started to mention that was a group, this was a group starting to form who were, in a sense, rebelling against the stuff going on in Jerusalem in particular, but, you know, influencing the Jewish
faith. Yeah.
And they were starting to get a bit aggravated about this.
They sure are.
The Hasidim ultimately became the Pharisees.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. So they were very focused on the law. And so that's starting to bubble here at this point.
That's right. Yeah. So another Seleucid emperor, new Seleucid emperor comes, and his approach is going to be quite different. Now, what happens here is that the brother of Ananias, the high priest at this stage, a guy called Jason, who is right into all of the Hellenization.
Jason? Really?
Yep, that's right. His name is Jason.
It kind of just doesn't fit. Anyway, Jason. Anyway.
He goes to Antiochus IV, and he actually buys the high priesthood with the promise. So not only does he offer him all of this money, but he promises to convert Jerusalem into a Greek polis, right? Because he realizes that Antiochus IV is right into, you know, he wants to make his realm into a Hellenistic cultural realm.
Right. So was he of the right lineage to do that? Or did that not matter?
Well, he was the brother of
Ananias.
He was the brother of Ananias, so he was still a Zadokite priest.
So the Jews might have been okay with that?
Well, a little. They were okay with him in one sense, not okay with him buying it off the emperor. Off the king, essentially. Yep. But even more not okay with him, with the, you know, promise to make this into Greek polis. Anyway, he's given the high priesthood, and he builds a gymnasium in Jerusalem, as you said. Yep. He's the one that builds that right next to the temple. And, I mean, this is a disaster. I mean, it's right next to the temple, so this is very inflammatory. But a lot of Jews become very enthusiastic for this. Many of them actually go through the very painful procedure of reversing their circumcision, because remember, they're competing in the nude, and
they want to look like everyone else.
That's right. And look, you know, most people will be familiar with the Greek statues of the ideal sort of Greek nude. Mm. Everyone wanted to look like that, right?
Yeah.
And that didn't involve being circumcised.
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of Jews reversing their circumcision. Now, this is, you can imagine the Hasidic reaction to this just grows in vehemence. Yeah. So you've got Jewish society being split.
And they take those are pretty massive sort of steps to sort of, in a sense, integrate in, really, isn't it? It's like,
My
goodness me. It's like, seriously. It's,
exactly. Like they're making some sacrifices here, you know, with some pain to actually
so clearly it
assimilate,
matters to them.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, things are getting polarized, but even more so when 3 years after Jason's appointment, another rich priest, but not a Zadokite. Now, this is important. A guy called Menelaus, he offers even more money, right, to Antiochus, and he's then appointed priest. So he's not a Zadokite priest. Worse still, not only is he not a Zadokite priest, but he takes treasures from the temple to pay for this. So
that's not going to be a good move.
Right.
No.
Yeah. And this is absolute sacrilege. Okay.
Mm, yeah.
And on top of that, he's an even more radical Hellenizer. Things are getting worse and worse. And this actually, his appointment, you know, was so unpopular, actually had to be enforced by, you know, forcefully, essentially.
So essentially, this is really probably where the straw broke the camel's back, to some degree anyway.
Yeah. Now, meantime, Antiochus, remember, he's a Seleucid, and the Seleucids are up north. They're in Syria. They're in Syria. He decides, right, he's going to take on the Ptolemies. He's going to take over Egypt. So he goes to battle. I mean, the war's successful at first, but he needs funds, right? Because wars are expensive things, okay? So he goes north to Jerusalem, where Menelaus welcomes him, of course, because he's the one that's keeping him in the priesthood. Because remember, the priesthood is a powerful
position,
political position as well. He escorts him into the temple to take all the sacred vessels, mind you, right?
Well, that's to pay for the war.
Yeah, he's got to pay for. Now, this again, this is just heating up the
you can totally
sort of Hasidic,
too, can't you?
Hasidic reaction to this. So he goes south. He's opposed. I mean, and this is where the Romans come in now. So when he returns to fight Egypt, he's actually opposed by the Roman allies, because the Romans were allied with the Ptolemies at this stage. And they demanded his withdrawal. Now, the rumor gets about...
His withdrawal from Jerusalem?
No, his withdrawal from... Because he goes Ptolemy's. Back to Egypt,
yep,
right?
Yep.
Because he's got more money, yep, right? I can pay for more mercenaries.
Right, so he goes back.
Go back, you know, to finish off the... You know, to finish off the war, the Romans say, no, you don't. Now, the word gets
gets out that,
and in fact, there's a rumor goes around that he's actually died, right? And now, when Jason, remember Jason, who was deposed by Menelaus, he hears this, he comes back, he attacks Jerusalem because he's going to take back the priesthood. So, you got this infighting.
Oh, boy.
Antioch, of course, isn't dead. So, he comes back, he crushes Jason's forces. And he's just...
He's getting fed up with the Jews, really.
He's just a bit sick of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he just decides, right, that's it. I'm going to completely take over this realm. Mm. I think he realizes quite rightly that the Jews are so difficult to work with precisely because of their religion.
Yeah.
This is the thing that is making this difficult. So he thinks, well, I'll just wipe out their religion. Now, in the past... This has worked in various, not often, right? Yeah. But in, you know, there are examples in the past of where, you know, the worship of one god has been enforced over the worship of another god in an area, right? Mm. And usually that is fairly painless, right? So there's some, I mean, there's still some effort required, but fairly painless because on the whole, people, you know, all right, whatever. Yeah. You know, they believe in many gods. Okay, so this is obviously the stronger god. Now I'll just change the worship of gods.
Yeah.
So he thinks
that's what's going to
happen. This is going to be, look, I'll just outlaw Judaism and that'll just make this simpler because that's the problem. This turns out to be the biggest mistake of his life because he doesn't know these people that he's dealing with, right?
Yeah. And so we're around 167 BC.
You're at 167 BC.
Yep.
He's going to make Judea into a pagan Greek city-state. He outlaws Judaism outright.
Mm.
Okay, this is massive. In 167, Judaism outlawed. The temple services closed down. Scriptures were destroyed.
Wow.
Sabbaths and other festivals couldn't be observed. Food laws were abolished and circumcision was made illegal. He then erects a pagan altar on top of the altar of burnt offering, an altar to Zeus. Okay, now this is the abomination of desolation that Daniel refers to. Okay, he commands all the people to worship Zeus. He enforces the eating of pork. I mean, he just goes all the way with this. Like he forces them to eat pork. There's a famous story of a pious man called Eliezer and his seven sons, and this is in the second book of Maccabees, where he is forced to eat pork and Eliezer refuses and he's basically tortured to death. And they've never, you know, these people have never seen anything like, they've never seen anything like this. I mean, why would you?
People don't
hold on like this normally.
Right.
And then to add to that, then he has seven sons. So this guy, Eliezer, has these seven sons and they then are one by one brought out and, you know, made to eat pork. And one by one, they are subject to the cruelest tortures. Honestly, they are skinned alive. It says, you know, they're fried in a giant, I mean, it's terrible. And they undergo this incredibly intense tortures. But one by one, they just refuse to eat, you know, to eat. It's just for the sake of eating a bit of pork, right?
Yeah.
But they, one by one, they refuse to do this. It's interesting, actually, in the account in Second Maccabees, they expressly put their hope in the resurrection of the dead. And so one by one, and then finally with the mother, and even then she won't give. And they have never
come across this before.
In fact, this is really the first, historically, the first great persecution known in history.
Yeah.
This is the first religious persecution.
Yeah, right.
Now, it's not the first time that the worship of a god had been outlawed.
Obviously,
and as
Babylon,
I said, normally people just go with it, right?
Yeah.
This is the first time people go through these incredible tortures.
Yeah.
And so the whole, this is the first account of sort of mass martyrdom. And the whole idea of martyrdom for your faith actually begins here.
Yeah.
At this point, because not only this, I mean, that's just one story.
Yeah, there are thousands.
There are thousands and thousands of stories where Jews are subject to these tortures
and die in large numbers.
And die for their faith.
Exactly.
And so this is a time of a mass martyrdom. And
yeah.
this is going to, Stu, this is going to solidify something about the Jewish faith. You know, we said at the start, the Judaism that we see in the New Testament, this is a Judaism that has been hardened through persecution. Yeah. Right? It's law keeping, right? Yeah. There's another terrible story of a mother who has her children circumcised, and the children are killed and hung about her neck, and then she's thrown off the temple. I mean, it's this terrible because she won't, because she insisted, right? Mm. She insisted on having her children circumcised. Mm. So when all of the talk about circumcision and Jewish identity in the New Testament, you sort of get why they hold on to these things, because for them, it's the thing that marks them out, right? People had died for this in the past. This is why it's not a small issue by the time you get to the New Testament. So this basically, this widespread religious persecution. I mean, the proverbial hits the fan at this stage. Yeah. It's just terrible. And in fact, a lot of people go out and they live in the mountains to escape from this. They go and live in caves. Yeah. And there's one big settlement actually that gets attacked by Antiochus's armies. And they won't defend themselves because it's the Sabbath. Because they know we'll attack on the Sabbath and they won't defend themselves.
Right, okay.
And so this, these thousand, all of these families that just get completely slaughtered because they won't even come out, in fact. Yeah. They tell them to come out, but the Sabbath law says you can only go so far.
And they knew that. So they're doing exactly the same thing they did with the pork. They're trying to make them break the law.
Yeah, that's right.
So that way, essentially, it's trying to break down the law and the faith.
Yeah.
And they won't come out
they're all slaughtered. Actually, after this, they kind of, the Jews agree together, listen, if we're attacked on the Sabbath, we need to be able to defend ourselves. Mm. And so they give themselves
that allowance. Now, a lot of those caves are now, they've been converted into places.
Kind of shrines to the martyrs in a way, yeah. Anyway, there's a famous, it's at this point that we get this very famous story, Stu, about this priest called Mattathiah, and he lives in a town called Modin, and the officials, Antioch's officials come in and they say, okay, come on now, you offer this sacrifice. And he refuses. He says, no, I and my sons, we're going to worship the Lord alone. So then someone else, another priest, steps forward to do this. And this is where he actually,
Mattathias steps in.
He kills the Jew that is going to offer this sacrifice. And then he goes and kills all the officials.
Yeah.
And of course, he then flees to the mountains. And he draws bands of followers to
kind
him.
Kind of forms this guerrilla force, doesn't he? Really?
Yeah, he's got these sons, these five sons, and they hide in the hills. And they actually form a very powerful guerrilla force because a lot of people, gather to them. They become important leaders. Yep. And by this stage, there are plenty of people willing to gather to them. And what they do is that they do these sudden raids on towns. They go in and they kill the king's troops, they destroy pagan altars, they kill Hellenizing Jews. So they sort of, they come in and they go out,
but like Robin Hood.
Yeah, it's kind of, this kind of Robin Zorro Hood band that live, in the mountains. Now, at this point, Antiochus' army was occupied in the east, right?
Yeah,
so, the rebels are able to do a lot of damage at this point, pretty much unchecked. And they become known as the Maccabees, right? Which is, Maccabee is the word for hammer, right? And so this is the time of the Maccabees. The Maccabees refers to this
rebel group
family. Yep. Now their family name is Hasmon. They are known as Hasmoneans as well.
Okay,
because they come from a common, their ancestor is Hasmon, and so these are the Hasmoneans as well. So we're gonna talk a little bit, soon. We'll get there.
Yep.
About the Hasmonean dynasty.
Take a breath, everyone. We're pushing on.
That's right. Take a breath. So Mattathias actually dies soon after, about a year after this, and his son Judas takes charge. And he is a brilliant tactician. He's a brilliant guerrilla leader, smart guy. And he almost becomes this sort of messianic figure, Stu.
Well, he builds a bit of an army around
him.
And
they see him as a divinely appointed deliverer, right?
Yeah.
You talked about the sense of God being, everyone at the time sees this is, and he's a divinely, God has raised up this guy.
And he was quite pious as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, everything he would have done, it would have been with God's help in a sense from his perspective. It wasn't imagining that he was some amazing.
He feels a sense of call from God, you know, to do this, right? Now, Antiochus actually completely underestimates the severity. I mean, there's a few rebels there and, you know, we'll send,
How big a problem is that?
3,000 soldiers and that should do because there's only 900 of them, right? And we're all trained. Yep. They're just a bunch of farmers.
We've got weapons they have.
Yeah, they're just a bunch of Jewish farmers, right? And we've got, you know, better weapons. And so, I mean, they just wipe him out with absolute ease, right?
And so hang on. So who wipes who out? So Judas wipes out
these 3,000 soldiers that Antiochus sends in.
Yeah.
So then Antiochus thinks, so he then thinks, I'll double the size, right? So he sends in an army twice the size.
About
now,
6,000.
Again, they're defeated with relative ease. Mm. So he thinks, right, okay, I've got to squash this. Really got to squash this now because this is becoming a problem.
They think they're the hammer. Let me show them a hammer.
That's right. So he's going to hammer them. Mm. So he actually gets his best general, a guy called Lysias. And Lysias goes in with a vast army, 47,000 troops
against sort of 900,
which included all the most recent armor, all the most recent military weaponry, including war elephants. These guys have never seen elephants. Imagine,
see this thing coming towards you.
They've never seen elephants in their lives, right? So you've got these war elephants coming with this vast, vast force. At this point in the Book of Maccabees, it feels like you're reading something from the scripture. And I think, you know, this is why, you know, these stories are included there in some Bibles because there's this sense that, you know, God was at work. And of course, the Jewish people don't include, they're not part of the Tanakh, which is the Jewish Bible, but they definitely these stories are, you know, they're seen as just being crucial to Jewish identity in many ways. So there's this great moment where, you know, Judas leads the people in this time of prayer and fasting and they seek God's help, you know, because you've got this vast army.
And elephants.
You're saying, look, you know, we are on the cusp of being completely wiped out. Because at this point, Antiochus is going to completely wipe them out as a people. He's going now for complete genocide, right? That's what I have to
eliminate
do.
Yeah, I can't nuisance.
I can't convert them. No, so I'm just going to go for genocide here. So
they pray.
So they pray, and amazingly, and this is the incredible thing, is that Judas and his very small
army, probably about
10,000, because more people have come to his aid. Yep. You know, I mean, you know, still only around 10,000.
Yeah.
They managed to rout.
Because
by the time you get a certain amount of success in these vast armies, the problem with these vast armies,
they're not very agile.
Yeah, they're not very agile. And also the hills of Judea. I mean, when I remember when I went there the first time and we drove through the hills of Judea and they're very rocky and hill. And I thought, okay, now I can see why guerrilla warfare would have worked so well, you know, in this area. Mm. But even with that, though, the odds were alarmingly against him.
But Judas knew the territory way better than the army did.
Yeah.
And they were pretty easy to see coming. It's not like they were a small group. You know, like here's all these elephants walking towards you.
But still quite a remarkable defeat.
Totally. Oh, totally.
So he defeats the 47,000.
And this is still Lysias at command?
This is still Lysias. Yeah. Now, after this, Lysias comes back, thinks this is just, and he gathers people from all over the empire, right? And he comes back with a force this time of 65,000, right?
Boy.
And it's actually probably only at this point now where, because I think it was, probably wouldn't have been quite 10,000 Judas army even at that previous point. Mm. It's actually only now that he's starting to, because now everyone's thinking, man, because this amazing victory against this vast army.
Gee, we could win here. Oh, maybe God is on our side.
That's exactly. So the Jews are thinking, oh man, maybe God is on our side.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably a lot of repentance. Mm. A lot of the Jews who thought, oh man, like.
We got this wrong.
Yeah, we really got this wrong and are starting to see that God's at work here and God's being faithful. And so, you know, he's got more soldiers, but still probably not more than, you know, 15,000, 20,000. And so he just completely outmaneuvers this vast army. And yet again, you get this even more remarkable victory at this point. Impossible victory is won again and using guerrilla tactics, he's able to.
He's quite a strategist, isn't he?
He's quite a strategist.
He kind of fools them at one point, I think, where, you know, they all think that they're in camp and they sneak out of the camp. This is Judas and his crew. So while they're trying to attack him, he's actually sneaking out and getting ready to attack them. Anyway, he's very, very shrewd. Obviously, well experienced fighting in that territory.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. Yep. So with Antiochus,
pushed
with
back.
The Greeks, you know, warded off, they come back to the temple, which had been desecrated, and there's this famous moment where they rededicate the temple, this 8-day festival, you know, where they rededicate
which
the
is
temple.
Still celebrated today.
And this is still celebrated to this day by Jewish people as the festival of Hanukkah. Mm. Okay, so this is 164 BC, festival of Hanukkah, and it's still remembered to this day as a mighty deliverance of God.
So this is rededication of the temple because of the abomination that was sacrificed there. They remove all of that. They even remove the stones, that they were sacrificed on, and they're not really sure what to do with those. They reinstate the temple as it should be.
Yeah.
And then they rededicate it to God.
Now, at this point, I mean, still formally, they're still supposedly under the under Greek,
rule.
I mean, Antiochus, you know, supposedly is still in charge of this realm. He decides, okay, I won't.
You can be Jews again. It's okay.
He sort of realizes his mistake. And in fact, in one of the Book of Maccabees, this is in both 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which both tell the same story. They have this account where just before his death, he's completely dejected and, you know, realizes his armies have been completely wiped out, and he's, you know, he acknowledges this is the God's curses upon me because of what I did in Jerusalem.
Wow.
And so that's now whether that happened or not, I mean, we're, you know, not sure, but I mean, but you could imagine.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I think there's probably some veracity to that. In the sense that no one's non-religious in this ancient world. So he would have thought, my word, what just happened there, right? And I think it's quite likely that he would have recognized that he was in the wrong. And by desecrating this temple, the God of the Jews has actually cursed me. So I think actually that's quite likely.
And let's remember when the first time they came to Jerusalem, of course, the priest came out to meet them. And who was it that had the vision at that point in time? I'm sure that story was passed down as well. So there's a sense of,
So it's Alexander's vision.
That's
right. Now, so they're free in one sense, but they're not fully independent yet. At this point, the Hasmoneans say, right, let's stop there, no more.
We've got what we wanted.
Right? Because
we're not trying to conquer the world. We just want
religious freedom. Exist. Right. So the Hasidim, you know, they're content to stop there, but the Hasmoneans, you know, Judas and his, you know, they want to go further. Mm. This essentially now becomes a full-blown war of independence. Mm. Now, it's interesting, actually, that from this point, it's not as smooth as it was before. Mm. Things now get political, and it's now about a war of independence.
And obviously, there's a bit of infighting that begins.
And it's certainly not smooth, right? It's certainly not smooth. And in fact, in one loss, important loss, Judas himself is killed. And Jonathan, his brother, takes over as the leader. Now, Jonathan is a politician, really. He's not the military strategist that his brother is. He's going to do lots of negotiation. So essentially, they are going to, you know, spoiler, they do win their independence.
Yeah, they do.
But it's going to be through strategy, pretty much. So he's going to play off factions, because remember, there's the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and then there's Rome
starting
as well.
Starting to rise.
Right, there's the rise of Rome. You know, there's all sorts of things going on. Is Sparta as well, actually, is an important force as well. So Jonathan, he's going to use his negotiating skills. That's going to be the key to his success. So,
Now, around about this time, there's another group that leave and head to northern Egypt and build another temple, essentially, another kind of replica temple. We've got this group in the south, and we've got now another group in the north.
And we're going to have yet another group that's going to come, because what happens that's going to break away, another group's going to break away. Because see, what happens at this point is that Jonathan, because remember, one thing we haven't addressed is, well, what about the high priesthood? Okay. Now, in some ways, fairly controversially and somewhat ironically, Jonathan Mattathias was a priest. His father was, so they're from a priestly family.
Not a Zadokite.
They're not Zadokite priests, right? Mm. This is one of the issues with Jason. Mm. At least he was a Zadokite priest and Menelaus, who wasn't. So what happens at this stage is that Jonathan takes on the high priesthood.
Does he have to pay for that as well?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't.
He just takes it on.
Yeah, I mean, he's, because they're still not fully independent. Right. So, you know, with the Seleucid, you know, with their kind of permission in one sense, because they've got religious independence in one sense, but they're still politically connected with the Seleucids. They're governed still. But remember, the priesthood is this political / religious position. So, so he's given the high priesthood. Now, this is problematic, and obviously someone at this point, we don't know who, but a Zadokite priest at this point is actually deposed.
Jonathan can take his place.
So the Zadokites were reinstalled at the rededication of the temple.
Yep.
So, but this guy is deposed so that Jonathan can take the high priesthood. And the unknown man who was deposed, who had, you know, this much more rightful claim to the high priesthood, he probably became the founder of this religious sect in Qumran that we know as the Essenes.
Okay? Right.
So there's any listeners who have visited, done an Israel trip, you probably would have visited the Qumran community site. It's right there on the edge of the Dead Sea. It was like a monastic sect, right? And they separated themselves because they saw the Hasmoneans as usurpers of the high priestly role. And so they were
not legitimate.
Yep. Yeah. And so they were this sort of apocalyptic sect. They were going to separate themselves, and they're going to await the coming of the righteous one.
And that's where the Dead Sea Scrolls.
And that's the Dead Sea Scrolls that they produce.
They produce those, yeah.
Look, eventually, you know, to cut a long story short.
Well, a couple of things just before we do, because I think the Egyptian communities are fairly, there's a Zadokite priest in the north, in the Egypt, which brings relevance to Jesus's birth and why perhaps Mary and Joseph fled to Egypt, because there was already a really strong Jewish community there. So there's a lot to do in terms of Egypt and the Jewish religion continuing.
Right. And of course, through all of these things that are happening, all of the events that we've described, there are lots of Jews going to places that they see as being safer, and Egypt is seen as one of those places. That's why there's a large Jewish community there. So anyway, through various shenanigans during this time to cut, you know, Jonathan actually is killed, is actually assassinated. And Simon, his brother, there's yet another, remember there's five brothers.
Five.
And he becomes the new leader. And this is actually when he's exempted from paying tribute to the Seleucids. They recognize this guy is really powerful. And that basically means they're an independent state. So they are now allowed to operate as a completely independent state. And this is 142 BC. Now, this is important because this is going to – this independent state of Judea, this Jewish state, is going to last for about 100 years.
Mm. And of course, the Romans are rising, and the Romans support this independent state.
That's
as well.
Right, so as well as Sparta. The Spartans are a force to be reckoned with as well.
Yep.
Rome more powerful at this point, but they both recognize this Jewish
independence. At that point, you know, that's important to recognize here because of what happens later as we get to when Jesus is born and the Romans' presence. In a sense, they're kind of invited in, really, because they want the Romans to support their independence claim.
Yeah,
you know,
which, exactly. Yeah, say, exactly. So that becomes an interesting detail for later.
Yeah.
Now, Simon actually was quite a wise ruler, and he unites the Jews under his rule. He was also made high priest in place of his brother Jonathan. I mean, the people, though, seem to be okay with this. They're still, and remember, the real objectors have tended to leave anyway, but the, you know, on the whole, you know, he's much loved. The Maccabee, you know, the Hasmonean family, these guys, that they're seen as, you know, divinely appointed deliverers, and so, you know, the people are okay with this, and he's able to unite the Jews under his rule. However, that doesn't stop him being assassinated by his son-in-law, who was one of his generals in a bid for power in 135 BC, and he's replaced by his son, Simon's son, John Hyrcanus. And this is, John Hyrcanus has quite a fruitful rule. This is, John's rule becomes a bit of a golden age for that time. There still is tension here with the Hasidim. Are still, they're the ones that have just got a bit of a problem with this priestly administrative family. You know, they're not Zadokites. And this is the beginning, this really is where the Pharisaic party becomes important.
Right.
As an opposition, that they become this sort of opposition group to the Hasmonean dynasty.
Right. And as the Hasmoneans, do they become the Sadducees? Is that? No.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Sadducees are, yes, essentially the Sadducees are a priestly group. You know, they're the leading priestly families.
Right.
So essentially the Sadducees support the Hasmonean dynasty, whereas the Pharisees,
right.
they're a bit more purist, right?
Right.
And they want to see a Zadokite priesthood installed. So because, I mean, ironically at this stage, there is a bit of Hellenization happening through this period. And so, you know, the Hasidim or the Pharisees are the ones that are opposing this. So so there's actually, at this stage, there's a sort of a Senate that's set up, though. And the Senate, in order to keep the people united, the Pharisees are given a sort of a, you know, place in that Senate. So there's the Sadducees and the Pharisees, as well as, you know, a couple of other groups that make up this, essentially this Senate that's known as the Sanhedrin. Now we see the Sanhedrin, we hear more about during the life of Christ. So John actually extends Judean territories further, and now actually it's his territory is as big as the territory of David and Solomon.
Wow.
So we have a 100-year independent Jewish state that is as big as that of David and Solomon. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
goodness,
that this happened.
Having defeated a 60,000 strong army only 30, 40 years before.
Exactly. Yeah it's pretty amazing. Now, he actually conquered this important, one of the important things that he does is that he conquers this group known as the Idumeans in the south. Idumeans were a sort of a mixed group. There were Edomites and non-Jewish people, but they are made into, essentially, they become forced converts.
Right.
So they're circumcised, and is going to come back to bite them because the Herodian family that we're going to hear that we hear about in the New Testament, they are Idumeans. Right? And so because you wonder how does an Idumean become the king of the Jews?
Yes,
You know, Herod becomes the king of the Jews. Yeah. Well, that's because the family was forced to become Jewish, but always seen as second, not really the real thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So this becomes problematic. He hates the Samaritans. John hates the Samaritans in the north. You know, he destroys their shrine. I mean, there's no love lost there with the Samaritans in the north. Anyway, after him, his son succeeds him, Aristobulus. He only rules for a year. But what he does do, Aristobulus does in that year, is that he takes control of a lot of Galilee during his reign. And that area was thoroughly Judaized, Galilee. And a lot of
Hellenism was pushed out.
A lot of Pharisaic presence up there. Now, this is important because this becomes a stronghold. Galilee becomes a stronghold of Jewish pietism and patriotism.
Yeah.
And that's very evident, actually, in the Gospels, right? Because, you know, Jesus is up there in Capernaum and all.
And
that's all up in Galilee, right? But this is, at this time, becomes a stronghold.
And, of course, his new approach to the law, in a sense, he wasn't accepted in Galilee, you know, because
that's right.
They were so, in a sense, legalistic about the law, in a sense,
I mean, ironically, as I said, during this time, there's this gradual Hellenization, though, that's happening as well. And after Aristobulus, we have Alexander Janaeus, and he's a half-brother of Aristobulus, and he becomes king when Aristobulus dies. And this is where things start to crumble at this point. It's like, this is, you know, like, it's great, you know, yay, there's this 100-year period of independence. The way it breaks down, and this is, I think, interesting, because the way this starts to break down is not because of external pressure. I mean, they have proved that they can withstand external pressure. It's actually internal corruption.
Yeah.
Yep. It's internal corruption really that brings this Jewish state down at this point. And this begins somewhat with Alexander Janaeus. He becomes really unpopular. He's an absolutely oppressive rule. He hardens Pharisaic opposition, so he's polarizing opinion against himself. You know, he's ironically allowing sort of gradual Hellenization to continue. I mean, at one point there's an open demonstration at a Feast of Tabernacles where he's pelted by fruit.
What year are we in now, Matt? Just give me historically, roughly whereabouts are we?
So we're
120?
Yeah, we're about, yep, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah, we're about 120 here.
Yep. BC. Yep.
He answers, so he's pelted with fruit. He sends out his troops and they kill 600 of the demonstrator. So he's heavy-handed, heavy-handed ruler. You know, I mean, there's another, this basically things break down into a six-year civil war. He uses Greek mercenary troops. He wins this the civil war. He crucifies 800 of the rebels. I mean, crucifixion is a an absolute terrible pagan punishment, essentially.
And that's the influence of the Romans too, to some degree, because that was a Roman. Predominantly a Roman punishment.
Exactly. Yep. So he crucifies 800 of the rebels, slaughtering their family before their eyes. When he dies, he dies in 78 BC, and there's just a really bitter taste in the mouth of the people now. So the Hasmonean rule now is not what it used to be, you know, and he actually bequeaths his rule to his wife. Now, interestingly, she actually does quite well. She rules for 9 years. Gee. And she actually just outstrips everyone. I mean, she rules for 9 years, and this 9 year becomes a bit of a golden age, actually, because she makes peace with the Pharisaic party. She's a very wise ruler, and
that would have been unusual, wouldn't it, to have a woman ruling? I mean, obviously we've got Cleopatra in Egypt,
rabbinic tradition, as I said, treats her rule very kind. It certainly is something of a golden age. She has two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Now, she can't be high priest, so she installs her son Hyrcanus in this rule. Now, when she dies in 67, of course, there's this tussle between them over. And this is what I mean about what really brings down the Hasmonean dynasty in a sense, because they're fighting against each other. And a guy that gets involved in this fight and really stokes the fires of this civil war, essentially that this civil war breaks out now, is a guy called Antipater. And he is the father of Herod the Great, right?
Right.
And he maneuvers his way into situation. I mean, you know, he's kind of a guy of not much repute, but he's very brilliant. He's a brilliant warlord. Mm. He's a brilliant horseman. Mm. He leads this cavalry. And he manages to sort of
subjugate,
get involved in things at this stage. Now, at one point, both Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II,
brothers,
these brothers, they both appeal to Rome. Right. So you know, the Roman rule that is lamented, you know, in the New Testament times, you know, that's well known that they're lamenting Roman overlordship. Basically, Rome were invited into into this fray.
And Rome decided to take advantage of the fact that these two, okay, here's an opportunity for us.
That's right.
You know, let's put these off against each other and then we'll go in there and sort it out.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, so, you know, Aristobulus kind of wins that, you know, they both offer large sums of money and he sort of wins the bid, but then he decides stupidly to oppose the Romans and you know, they destroy him resoundingly. And this is the general Pompey. Famous General Pompey that conquers Jerusalem. I mean, he'd basically been invited in and takes advantage
from the inside out.
It's not hard. He infamously walks into the Holy of Holies, right into the temple. Oh, let's see what sort of God these Jews. And he's actually shocked to find that there's actually nothing in there. You know, I mean, what happened? But look, the Jews never forget this. No, this is a great sacrilege. So this is
kind of getting close to,
you know, 63. This is 63 BC, and this is finally Jewish independence is lost.
Roman rules here,
and they are now a Jewish state of Rome, essentially. Yeah. And this is where, you know, this is familiar to us from the New Testament. And many Jews at this point are taken back to Rome. This is actually, they're eventually freed and they become the core of what is going to be the Jewish Roman community.
That
are going to become that Paul writes to forth. Okay. So that's
where that begins.
That happens.
Yeah.
So at this point, there is almost every year, it's like there is one revolt after another against Roman rule.
Yeah.
And again, they are crushed. It's like 1 year after another.
And you can see why the Romans are getting fed up with it. Like everyone else. These Jews, we should have learned from the Greeks or the Persians or everyone else who ever tried to take these guys.
Absolutely fed up with this, you know.
Yep.
But it's interesting because Antipater, this guy that I mentioned, Herod the Great's father, he actually sides with the Romans. He helps the Romans out. And then his son Herod, he has these sons. His son Herod also helps the Romans out. You know, Herod is manages to put down, there are these brigands operating in Judah mm-hmm. against Roman rule. I mean, this is the sort of zealots, you know. He manages to put down these zealot brigades, and for his trouble, you know, he is eventually in 37 BC, he is made the king. Actually, not just,
right. Now, okay.
I mean, Antipater was given the governorship for helping the Romans mm-hmm. out because he helps the Romans put down some of these rebellions. Mm. Now, Antipater, I think, very wisely thinks, yeah, I'm an Idumean. Me being king of the Jews, that's not going to go down very well, right? I'm not going to, you know,
he's not going to force that.
Like, I'm not going to sort of mess with these people too much, you know, because let's learn from history here. Yep. Herod, you know, he's got a bigger ego mm-hmm. and not nearly as much wisdom.
Yep.
He's a great warrior and he's heavy-handed. He befriends Octavian at this point, the Emperor Octavian, and he's given the kingship of Judah. And
The
rest is history. So this is where, of course, the New Testament begins. And you know, I mean, he is a heavy-handed ruler. And I mean, his rule is very interesting. But that brings us to the New Testament times.
Which is fantastic. So, well, there you go.
What a story.
Great history lesson, Matt. Well delivered. It does shine a whole new light on where we pick up the story when we get to Matthew. Now, we are in Thrive. We're going to be sort of diverting a little bit. We're going to go back to the Old Testament and have a look at the book of Proverbs in our next episode of Thrive Deeper. But this kind of sets the scene really and helps us understand even more fully what's happening in those early times, particularly when Jesus is walking the earth in Jerusalem and around. And some of these things like the Samaritan woman asking that question, this puts the context around all
absolutely.
That, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, when Jesus went out and he announced the kingdom of God is at hand, you know what they were all thinking, this is going to be another Maccabean revolt, right? This is why Jesus, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, has to make it very explicit. No, this is a different kind of kingdom fought with different kind of weapons. And I think we really need to remember that today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.